Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. This is episode 48 of Text Messages, a second look at the Hunger Games. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. If young adult literature is more popular today than ever before, one reason is the existence of blockbuster novels like Suzanne Collins' The Hunger Games. With the recent development of a much-hyped movie version of The Hunger Games, Collins' story of a dystopian world where children are forced to fight to the death on live television is set to reach an even broader audience, which is good for the books and for our field. Ever since The Hunger Games was first released in 2008, I've been an admirer of this series, and I've enjoyed sharing the three books of the trilogy with other readers. The Hunger Games has consistently ranked as the most popular whole-class read in my college young adult literature class, which parallels the popularity of the books nationwide. At the time of this recording, the series had spent 80 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list for children's series books. According to Scholastic, the book's publisher, as of March 2012, there were more than 23 million copies of The Hunger Games in print, a number which is sure to grow as the movie leads even more people to the series. In anticipation of the movie premiere, I spent the past week rereading The Hunger Games, as well as its sequels, Catching Fire and Mockingjay. In this episode, I'll bring you my thoughts on these books and what they have to offer teen readers. I'll highlight themes that distinguish them as important works of literature, and I'll also share some background from Suzanne Collins on the seeds for the story. While I'll do my best to avoid giving away any detailed spoilers, my interest is in how the three books of the trilogy work together, and how they can be used to awaken political consciousness in teen readers. In light of the excitement around the movie, it's useful to look critically at the books themselves and remember what they're saying about the dangers of our entertainment culture, even as we ourselves flock to the theaters to be entertained. I'll start with a brief overview of the story. In the distant future, North America is known as the Nation of Panem, a collective of 13 districts ruled by a far-off city called the Capital. As punishment for an uprising by the districts known as the Dark Days, in which 12 districts were defeated and the 13th was obliterated, the remaining districts are now required to participate in an annual event called the Hunger Games. Each district must provide one boy and one girl, known as tributes, to compete in the games. Over the course of several weeks, these children, between the ages of 12 and 18, will fight to the death in a vast outdoor arena while the rest of the country watches on live television. The Hunger Games serve as a reminder of the absolute power of the Capital, but they also exist to mock and degrade the districts. While the tributes face a life and death struggle in the arena, the citizens of the Capital treat the games as a festive sporting event. Each tribute is given a prep team whose job it is to create costumes and a distinctive look for their tribute. Similar to the Olympics, the tributes march in opening ceremonies, and they sit for interviews with Caesar Flickman, a Dick Clark-like figure whose job it is to develop the tributes' on-screen personas. The greater a tribute's popularity, the greater his or her chance of survival, since sponsors in the television audience can send their favorite tributes life-saving food and medical supplies once the games begin. While the games are purely entertainment for those in the Capital, the stakes couldn't be higher for the tributes and their people back home in the districts. The tribute who wins each year's games is guaranteed a life of ease, and the district he or she represents will be showered with gifts, mostly in the form of food, in the following year. At the same time, the terms by which the games operate are brutally rigged against the poor. The odds of your name being selected are higher if you are starving, because you can receive tesserae, or a year's supply of grain and oil, if you agree to have your name entered more times in the drawing called the Reaping. At age 16, Katniss's name has been entered 20 times. But as a mark of just how arbitrary and cruel the games can be, it is Katniss's sister, 12-year-old Prim, whose name is drawn to represent their district. Desperate to save her sister from sure death in the arena, Katniss volunteers to take her place. With its combination of page-turning action and social commentary, The Hunger Games is one of those crossover novels that appeals to adults and teens alike. Readers who enjoy action and suspense are drawn to the book because of its central plot. We read to find out whether Katniss and her fellow tribute PETA will survive the horrific ordeal of the games. On another level, readers who enjoy romance can focus on the love triangle aspect of the story. When PETA declares his love for Katniss on national television before the games begin, she is furious with him, until she realizes that a romance could help them win favor with the audience. But the person she feels a real bond with is Gale, her old hunting partner from District 12. Katniss's struggle to understand her feelings for PETA and Gale is all the more significant when set against the backdrop of the games, where the pressure to perform for the cameras means one can never fully trust another's motives. Sorting out one's own motives isn't much easier. But beyond the appeal of romance and suspense, the Hunger Games books, at their core, are political. Fans who argue about whether they are Team PETA or Team Gale are missing something deeper if they fail to consider what the books are saying about the world PETA and Gale live in. As YA author Nancy Whirlin put it, the books are about human rights, the abuse of political power, and the necessity of rebellion against injustice. That's why it's so important to consider Suzanne Collins' remark that the Hunger Games story was always planned as a trilogy. In an interview posted at the Scholastic website, Collins said she knew the arc of the story from the beginning. It would move from gladiator game to revolution to war. Without the context of all three books, the message of the story is incomplete. Whenever Collins is asked about influences on the creation of The Hunger Games, she talks about the story's classical roots. She notes that the Greek myth of Theseus and the Minotaur is one seed for the story. Like The Hunger Games, the citizens of Athens were punished for past deeds by being forced to send 7 youths and 7 maidens to the island of Crete, where they were thrown into the labyrinth to be devoured by the Minotaur. Collins was struck by the ruthlessness of the story and the message it sent to citizens. Mess with us and we'll do something worse than kill you. We'll kill your children. As Collins writes in Mockingjay, something is significantly wrong with the creature that sacrifices its children's lives to settle its differences. The truth is, it benefits no one to live in a world where these things happen. Another important reference in the story is to the culture of ancient Rome, its gladiator games, but also the expression panem et circenses, which translates to bread and circuses. By naming the nation Katniss lives in, panem, Collins makes her point about the essence of that world. In ancient Rome, bread and circuses meant that people gave up their political responsibilities, and therefore their power, in exchange for full bellies and entertainment. It's easy to see how this applies to the citizens of the capital, with their excess of food and the Hunger Games as the ultimate form of entertainment. The people of the districts provide both the bread and the circuses. When contemplating abuse and brutality in the fictional worlds of dystopian literature, it's tempting to see those worlds as far removed from our own. Of course, we in the United States don't send our children to an annual fight to the death broadcast live on television. But there are a lot of things we do watch on television, including reality TV shows. Collins says that a key moment in conceptualizing the story of The Hunger Games occurred one night when she was channel surfing between reality television and actual coverage of the war in Iraq. The contrast between a group of young people competing for money and prizes and another group of people fighting an actual war caused the lines between those worlds to blur in an unsettling way. So what does it mean that we in the United States are obsessed with reality shows while wars and revolutions rage in other countries? What does it say about us that we enjoy the voyeuristic thrill of watching people being humiliated or brought to tears or suffering physically on television, especially when people in our local communities are suffering in much more silent ways? People on reality shows aren't killing each other. But is our interest in them really that different from the interest the people in the Capitol take in their tributes? Collins has said she hopes her readers will consider how elements of the book might be relevant to their own lives, and if the connections are disturbing, what they might do about them. Like any good author, Collins wants her books to raise questions in the minds of readers. Questions such as, how do we feel about the choices our government makes and the choices other governments make around the world? What does it mean that we live in a world where some take their next meal for granted while others are starving? And what is our relationship to reality television versus our relationship to the news? Thinking then about the Hunger Games movie, I have to admit that it's a little hard for me to see a favorite book be devoured by the masses. I know I'm being a book snob when I say that, but because The Hunger Games derives its power in large part from its unflinching political and social commentary, I can't help but worry that its power will be diluted by the commercial hype surrounding the film. What does it mean for us as readers that you can go online and buy a replica of a Hunger Games training shirt, the same one worn by the tributes as the majority of them trained for their deaths? I know there's profit to be made and visibility to be gained for these wonderful books through Hunger Games lunchboxes, charm bracelets, and coffee mugs, but it kind of hurts me to see t-shirts saying Happy Hunger Games and PETA has brothers. There's nothing happy about these games if you and your loved ones are fighting in them. And I have to apologize for this one small spoiler, but by the end of the series, PETA's family is dead. When I see captions on the internet attached to photographs from the movie, and they say things like, "Do you prefer your Katniss glammed up or dressed down?" And, "They may be getting ready for battle, but Katniss and PETA still look great in their District 12 uniforms," I have to believe that something really crucial about this story is getting lost in translation. Katniss ultimately decides to join the revolution against the Capitol when she reflects on what the government of Panem does to children. She chooses to fight because what has been done to them is so wrong, so beyond justification, so evil that there is no choice. I would argue that what the government does to the victors of the Hunger Games is equally reprehensible. As PETA says in Mockingjay, it costs more than your life to fight in the games. To murder innocent people, it costs everything you are. So we in the audience can flock to screenings of the Hunger Games movie and imagine ourselves as tributes, taking on the perspective of Katniss or PETA and imagining what it would be like to fight for our survival. But a more challenging way of watching the movie is to compare ourselves to the viewing audience in the Capitol. As Collins puts it, if there is no audience, there is no gladiator game. The same logic applies to the Hunger Games. Because people watch, the games hold power. Of course, not watching isn't really an option either if your loved one is in the arena. The night before the games begin, PETA tells Katniss that his best hope is not to disgrace himself. He wants to die as himself in the arena, not be turned into some kind of monster he's not. He wishes he could think of a way to show the Capitol that they don't own him, that he's more than just a piece in their games. As we prepare to watch the movie, Suzanne Collins asks us to consider the same issue for ourselves. How much will we allow ourselves to be caught up in the Capitol's game? And what does resistance in our own context look like? I hope you will read these books and recommend them to the teens in your life. Each title should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. Next month, I'll be back to bring you an interview with Francisco X. Stork, the author of Marcello in the Real World and Last Summer of the Death Warriors, which was last year's winner of the Amelia Elizabeth Walden Award. Stork's newest novel, Irises, was published in January. Until next time, I'm Jennifer Bueller. More episodes of Text Messages are available at www.readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at www.readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening, and look forward to more text messages soon.